Good morning, all. I'm Sagar Satule. I'm the potato breeder at Oregon State University. Today, I thought I will discuss what we have been doing with some of the genetic resources used. And actually, Gail gave a good point, like the use of wild germ plasm in the breeding program. And our program has been very active in using germ plasm resources. So before I start, I'll just give a brief update about our the Tri-State Breeding Program. Even though I'm part of the Oregon State University, we are part of the Tri-State Potato Variety Development Program, which is the largest potato breeding program in the whole world, where we are concentrated mostly on developing russet germplasm for the Northwest industry. It's kind of a cooperative effort between the land-grant universities and the USDA. Way back in 1985, they decided they used to have the USDA potato breeding program at Aberdeen, Idaho. Then the land-grant universities of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, basically Oregon State University, Washington State University, and University of Idaho, they joined together and they said, okay, let's the USDA concentrate more on the germplasm improvement and breeding, and let the universities take care of all the selection and evaluation process. So it's a collaborative effort with more than 30 years of strong collaboration, and we have released more than 30 varieties, and the topmost, except for us at Burbank, the top cultivars came through this Tri-State program. If you look at our approach for the breeding, basically we have two breeding entities. One is USDA ARS down in Aberdeen, Idaho, and at Oregon State University we do some amount of breeding, but we share all our germplasm. And then during the course of selection process, it's not just the breeders select, but also the industry and the agronomists all come into picture and then do the selection process. And when it's about the time for release, like few years before the release, we give access for all these varieties to the industry, basically the processing industry, which is the French fry industry in our location. And they get a chance to evaluate all these new selections. And if once they see any selection that has the potential, then we'll go ahead and develop the management guidelines on one side. On the other side, we give exclusive rights to Potato Variety Management Institute, which is basically a grower-organized group that takes all the selections, and then they do the marketing and commercialization. So it's a dynamic process that involves a lot of researchers, agronomists, and also the industry people. So for any breeding program, first we have to have a definite set of objectives. And here is a brief outline of the objectives of the Tri-State Breeding Program. And if you look at our main goal is to develop russet potatoes for the industry. And if you look at the Idaho's program, they try to develop something called a dual purpose, where it can go as a fresh market or as a processing. But if you look at Oregon or the Columbia Basin of Oregon and Washington, we are mainly, the growers are segregated either as a processing growers or as a fresh market growers, and we don't have an overlap between those growers. So our breeding program at Oregon State University mainly tries to develop varieties either grow as a fresh market or as a processing industry. If you look at some of the important resistant traits we look at, one of the main things that my program works in is on the Columbia root knot nematode resistance, which is a major factor. The reason is, I don't know how much of you know about the potato production in the Columbia Basin of Oregon and Washington. That is the highest yielding location in the world with more than 40 tons per acre, but at the same time, our production costs are close to $3,000 an acre. Out of $3,000 an acre, $500, between $350 and $500 just go for fumigation purpose, mainly to control root knot nematode and verticillium wilt. So host genetic resistance is an important part that can reduce the fumigation cost, eventually economically benefits our growers. So as I said, our main goal is to develop varieties that benefit different segments of the Pacific Northwest potato industry. And in this presentation, I'm going to talk about why we are more important into root knot. So the Columbia root knot nematode is caused by the nematode Melanogaster chitwoodi. It is an endoparasite which is very hard to control. There are alternative host crops that you can use to control, but it's really tough. Highly prevalent in the Pacific Northwest region, exclusively, mostly in the Columbia Basin of Oregon and Washington. When it infects the roots, it forms the galls, and in the tubers, it forms, you can see here, a little bit of small, tiny spotches. And then when these things, when you started to fry those ones, then it becomes dark color fries, or with having this kind of dotted fries, which is highly unacceptable. At the same time, it is a very highly quarantined pest. And being in the northwest region, we have most of the shipment going out for export. So you need to be very careful how your potatoes are. So here is an example, you see, a severely infected russet tuber where you can see a lot of infestation. So it's almost a zero tolerance pest. So our program is highly involved in resistance breeding. Previously, we identified, screening identified a source that is resistant to root knot nematode, and we are basically doing intensive breeding and trying to develop varieties. So we decided what are the various approaches we are working on is to get the whole genome sequence of the source, which we are working on, which I'm going to talk later. And I don't know how many of you have worked with nematodes and nematode screening. It's really tough. It takes so many years and environment and all those things. And where, if you can develop markers to screen, which will be a perfect thing. At the same time, even though we have the resistant source, we are already seeing breakdown of resistance. So our lab is also trying to identify the genes. So what is the pathway associated with the resistance and also the pathway associated with the susceptibility? Side by side, because we already know currently existing resistance is not durable, so we are identifying new sources of resistances and by screening a lot of germplasm that we got from Sturgeon Bay. I also, in collaboration with the nematologist, effectors play a major role in resistance mechanism and also the breakdown of mechanism. So we are trying to see what kind of effectors are actually influencing the resistant mechanism and resistant breakdown mechanism. So this is overall what my program in Hermiston is working on. But in this presentation, I'm going to concentrate on one aspect, which is whole genome sequence development. So screening has identified, so long back in 1980s, USDA ARS Prosser, Dr. Chuck Brown's group has identified one clone from Mexico that is resistant to the root knot nematode in the Palau region, which is from Solanum bulbocastinum. As you may know or not, so Solanum tuberosum, which is the potato, is a tetraploid, and this is a diploid, and you can see it produces very tiny tubers and really a weedy species. And thanks to Ryan Contreras' group for helping us with doing some karyotyping. So we found it is a diploid because initially we had some issues. We are thinking it might be a mixoploid. So long back, the only way we can effectively use this introgression is using the protoplast fusion. And then previous studies have identified the gene controlling for resistance is a single dominant gene, and it's mapped to chromosome 11. And USDA ARS process has been trying to work to identify the gene for a long time, and they're having a lot of issues. But this is a flowchart. What happens, SB22 is the resistant clone, protoplast fused with one of the tuberosum tetraploid, and then when you got the fused product, screened for nematode resistance, and then subsequently made crosses. So this one is a pentaploid, and then you got up to tetraploid, and then eventually we are at this stage. We moved from this stage to this stage, and I don't know how many of you can judge how many years it took to come from this stage to this stage. It took more than 20 years to come from this stage to this stage. But at every stage, we have to do the screening and identify the clone that is resistant, taking the process really tedious. Here is an example to show in a heavily infested field how the russet Burbank looks versus the N82-4 looks. Still, it is not on par with the commercials, so we are using this and we are moving forward in terms of the variety development. So one of the important aspects is to develop molecular markers and how we can do it. So we started when I joined in 2012, I decided, okay, let's go ahead and with all this next generation sequencing, let's do a whole Illumina sequencing and try to see whether we get some good data. So this is a basically first version. We just used the Illumina-based sequencing. I was not very happy with the kind what we got. And then later on, we found PacBio sequencing can give us a very good data. So we went ahead and did the PacBio sequencing. And basically, I'm not very happy with that. And then we started to see whether we can use this scaffolding to get into a chromosome level using the high-rise assembly. And probably this is one of those projects where all the funding for this work came through the Growers Association. I never got any funding from any other federal agencies, but all the funding was through the Growers Association. So it shows how much important this work is for the growers of Oregon and Washington. So version one, we used one full flow cell of Illumina deep paired and sequencing, and then along with that we did libraries with MiSeq. We got a lot of data, and then we did basically a de novo assembly. Found we got around 450 megabases with very almost short reads. And then what we went ahead and we did the PacBio sequencing at Arizona Genomics Institute, where we used 20 kb and 35 kb library reads. And we generated more than around close to 40 GB of sequencing data, which results in a pretty fairly decent, almost like 2.3 MB of length on close to 600 MB. So if you look at the current reference genome of potato, the whole genome is close to like 750 is the assembled genome with few gaps. So we thought we were pretty close to it, and then let's start doing the high-res assembly where we can get all this PacBio sequencing and try to align with them with a chromosome level assembly. So if you look at our input assembly, which is basically the PacBio, we got around 600 MB, and then with the high-res assembly, we got the same amount, but when you look at the scaffolds, it moved from 75 long scaffolds to 6 scaffolds, and eventually into 13 scaffolds. As you know, it is a diploid. It's 12 chromosomes, but we are getting 13 major scaffolds. So there is something going on in that. So if you look at the genome assembly statistics, it's pretty much, if you look from PacBio to Dotel high-rise, you end up with gaps. But these gaps are where the joints are made, so where it basically connects the PacBio sequencing cuts and then try to get it into alignments, so you end up with gaps, and we really don't know whether the gap is 5 base pairs or 100 base pairs or in K base. But that gives at least a chromosome level of assembly. This is a histogram. What in high-res they do is a paired end, and if you can see the comparison between how the pair read 1 and read 2 are aligned together. So basically each bin is one chromosome kind of a scaffold. And here we have close to like 15 scaffolds. Well, what's going on? We have only 12 chromosomes, so we should have 12 scaffolds, but what is going on? So we went ahead and did the alignment with the Solanum tuberosum, our reference genome, and we found chromosome 1, we got alignment with 3 scaffolds, and then in chromosome 10, we have 2 scaffolds making it together. But our goal is mainly interested in the chromosome 11, where we have the resistant gene of interest. So this is again the box plot showing how the alignment between the tuberosum versus the scaffolds. You can see chromosome 1 has close to 3, and then chromosome 10 has 2 scaffolds aligning together. But overall, now it's almost on par with the reference genome that is available with the tuberosum. So we went ahead and did the repeats to see how much of the repeats. Surprisingly, the Solanum bulbocastrum has close to 50% in repeats, which is causing us difficulties in terms of fine alignment. So we're working, refining all these genomic tools to get more sequencing. We did some gene annotation, and there are close to like 32,000 genes, of which 24,000 are similarity with the tuberosum. And all this genomic data is available in our GBrowse for people to use it. So that's where we are with respect to our genome assembly. So breeding for resistance is an important trait in our breeding program. And our path biosequencing and the high-res assembly resulted in almost chromosome level, which is ready to use in the comparative genomics to develop molecular markers and do some comparative genomics with other species. And all this data is available in Oregon State University's website. So if anyone wants to use it, more than happy to get the sequence. Just